Welcome to this week's Two Men in the Middle. This is where two guys from the Midwest talk about politics and current affairs. I'm Craig Ewing.
I'm Brandon Koenig.
And I guess this week we're all going to talk about Omarosa for an hour.
The Omarosa show.
It's Omarosa. I was saying Omarosa, and it's like Omarosa.
Omarosa, yeah.
I like how they use all three of her names, just in case you thought it was the other Omarosa.
Yeah, right, because there's so many. We get them confused.
Because there's so many of them. So last week, right when we were shutting down for the hour, we kind of casually threw out, you know, are you interested in the Omarosa tapes at all? And it's like, we'll see what happens. It was kind of unknown at that point in time if this was going to take on any legs and go. And wow, did it really take on legs and go.
And it's continued too. Like, mm-hmm. It wasn't just like one day in the news cycle and then we moved on. Like, this has been like a trickle of details and information. And you got to hand it to Omarosa. I mean, she learned from the best. I mean, to draw this out, to do the media play and, you know, hit all of the main primetime shows.
She's not shying away from this. And you're right. She has held the media cycle for almost 5 or 6 days. That, and I understand how crass this sounds, but the only thing I can remember doing that in the last year is the Parkland school shooting.
Yeah.
And certainly that's not something you want to compete against. But to the point you just made, if there's anybody who knows how to get in front of a camera, knows how to hold that attention, and has an interest in keeping that cycle going, it's her. I also saw that her book, I think as of today, was number 2 on Amazon. It went from like number 6 to number 2. So she's trying to sell as many books as she can in as short a time period as she can.
Oh yeah, I'm getting plenty of exposure. I mean, she knows how to do it. And so I mean, not really surprised at all by any of this. I think what is kind of, you know, laughable is to see the White House, you know, completely just try to, you know, disregard her and, you know, and her character, you know. And this was somebody who, you know, went to great lengths, who was, you know, a supporter of theirs, who, you know, that was played up, and her role was played up, which was, you know, and she didn't do anything, but she fit a narrative that they wanted to have. And so
that narrative was an African-American, highly placed person, not a cabinet post, but somewhere around the presidency.
Yeah, it was to insulate them because even from the very beginning of the campaign, they were playing defense when it came to, you know, their strategy and the way that they, you know, addressed African-American concerns or lack thereof, you know, on the campaign trail. And so she was there to mitigate that. And then, you know, the irony on top of all that was they picked somebody who's, you know, has extremely polarizing, I mean, personality to mitigate that, who's not well-regarded in the African-American community at all.
No, not like a real voice of hope from that community. I mean, strength or accomplishment.
Right. This is somebody from the entertainment world.
Yes.
Who is a big self-promoter, who is all about building her own brand, who really hasn't held a real job in who knows how long other than, you know, I mean, she goes from one self-branding effort to the next.
Yeah.
I mean, as soon as she was let go from the White House, she was on Big Brother. I mean, it's just been, you know, one thing after the next. And then that was a lead-in for the revelations that came out last week and then the book. So she's played this off quite well going back to last year.
So Mike yelled at me one time when I said, Trump has filled the White House with C-level players, people that in any other administration wouldn't get a sniff, wouldn't even come close.
No, Craig, you have it all wrong. He picks the best people.
I know.
Just so, absolutely the best people.
Let's unpack best people, because I saw a tweet the other day with a picture, and it had Omarosa, Mike Flynn, Sebastian Gorka, Steve Bannon, and there was one other person. Oh, Pruitt.
Pruitt, yeah.
If you think about who he is, has surrounded himself with, one of the misconceptions of Donald Trump that The Apprentice built up was that he was this genius businessman. He knew how to create opportunities for other people. He surrounded himself with the best projects, the best people, and got the best results. And I think what we have found out over the last year and a half of him, let's even go back to the campaign, Manafort, Corey Lewandowski. If you look at everybody that surrounded him with, only there's only a layer of people that are damaged in some way that will hang out with the president to be part of what the president's trying to do.
Right.
And that should be a clear reflection on who he is personally and professionally as well.
Well, and everybody that he has surrounded himself with are ego boosters, people that have stoked his ego, praised him lavishly. You know, Omarosa had made a comment that, you know, people are going to be bowing before President Trump, which he apparently loved.
How horrifying is that?
This is how Trump picks people to work for him. I mean, if you go back to, you know, Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, it was the fact that he was an early campaign supporter. He chooses people based off of loyalty and what they say on TV about him. There was another person, I'm blanking on the name right now, that he plucked who was on all of the television shows, you know, and on Fox and Friends just praising it. I mean, he will go, and a lot of people know this now, if you want to be chosen for a White House job by this president, go on Fox and Friends, defend him, praise him, and that's the key to getting a job offer.
So there's one element of this story that just piles on the theme of he surrounded himself with folks who are over their head, shouldn't be in these positions, don't have the skill, and don't have the moral compass to be in their positions and in the White House.
Right.
And if you're in the White House, part of what you're there to do is to check the worst impulses of the president. This is the White House jobs are supposed to be close advisors, people you have a deep relationship, who know you personally and help you stay on the rails and aren't afraid to say, sir, you're getting out of bounds. We got to pull you back to where you need to be. So now that obviously is not the case. And this is just another example of something.
Was never the case from the beginning. I mean, and that's been the problem. You're supposed, as president, the norm has been to surround yourself with a team of rivals, people that challenge you, that counter you, that get you to think about alternative scenarios as far as policy goes. But the problem is, not only has he had people that have not countered him, he has people that have no policy expertise in the departments and areas that they're managing, which is why so many of these departments are in disarray. And if you look down several layers, you have employees and many of these agencies that are fleeing. I mean, it's just the turnover rate is just sky high, and it's because of the leadership at the top.
So now let's talk about how Trump responded to this. So I'm always a fan of at some point in time, you can get so angry or you can get so rattled that you actually have a moment of honesty. And I think Trump had a brief moment of Twitter honesty right in the middle of like his 8-tweet rant on Omarosa, which he went on like Tuesday. I think it was this week.
Yeah.
He basically said, she was a loser. She came to me crying. I gave her a job. I thought she was good because she always said great things about me.
I'm glad you mentioned that. That was revealing.
And John Kelly had to fire her. And then later, because she's a dog. And basically it went from she's a loser, a low life, a dog. But I did keep her around because she just said great things about me. And that's really the criteria for staying in Trump's orbit.
He was completely honest. Yeah.
The other thing, too, that's interesting is if you listen to Pod Save America with the three guys that were in Obama's administration, they talk about, apparently, if you even come within 5 feet of Donald Trump, you have to sign some sort of NDA. There's these NDAs that basically say you can't expose anything, you won't talk about anything. Right.
We knew that this was a factor on the campaign trail. Yeah. He had everybody on the campaign sign him. Even interns were expected to sign him that were unpaid. But we didn't have confirmation by the White House that this was something that was part of protocol until Kellyanne Conway just, you know, I think accidentally revealed it.
Yeah. And they talked about that was never part of the Obama White House.
No.
Nobody's ever signed an NDA.
Well, not just the Obama White House. That's not typical with past presidential administrations anyway, because it goes against the grain. Presidential administrations are supposed to have a certain level of transparency, and you cannot have that when you have NDAs in place.
And what we want you to do is, after you're gone, go talk about it.
Right.
Talk about how great we were. Write a book. Start a podcast. Spread the word about how awesome the administration was, how great we got along, and how much we did. I think this is something Trump basically brings from his corporate experience, but you know, it gives you a little bit of insight that he's trying to lock everybody down and control what everybody's messaging is going to be when they leave him, because he knows at some point we're all going to turn on each other and eat our own.
Well, that's kind of interesting because, I mean, we found out that, you know, he had NDAs when it came to his private life with all these women he's been with. So and why wouldn't that translate over to the, you know, his Trump. Professional life? So yeah. There are no difference.
So part of this is you know going in, you've got to sign something because you're going to see and hear things that you don't want anybody else to know. Then when the inevitable happens, where the relationship gets fractured, we're going our separate ways, you know Trump is going to turn on you at some point. And it's going to be personalized. There's going to be insults. He's going to demean your intelligence, your appearance. Whatever he feels he can press a button to push you down, that is always this guy's first response. And again, we're just kind of numbish to it now. I don't think everybody expects it.
Right.
You know the tweet storm's coming. You know what he's going to do. There was an interesting article that talked about people were upset because he called Omarosa a dog. And then they went through and started kind of laying out everybody Trump has called a dog. And it's like 19 people. That's one of his go-to phrases,
the terminology.
Is to call somebody a dog.
Yeah, he's not very creative in his attacks and terminology.
He finds one and just keeps on it over and over and over again.
But again, there's no shock value anymore. You're right about that. We don't really have any shock value. I think it's more sad and disappointing than anything, because the office of the presidency has been debased to this degree that we just expect this. And, you know, there was no expectation. I mean, this would have definitely shocked us, you know, at any given time prior to this. And this has just become a norm.
Yeah.
And that we've accepted another norm, another goalpost that's been moved.
So as a middle-aged white guy, we've talked about on this, even on the pod, when we've been talking something about women, something about minorities, I have a natural reflex to tense up. Because you know, I'm walking down an edge that if I say something or do something wrong, there could be some blowback to it. That's one of Trump's superpowers. Just doesn't care. Doesn't put one cycle worth of thought into, I'm just going to refer to an African-American woman as dumb, stupid, unattractive, a dog, and just feels there's no checking himself at all.
Right.
We talked about men last week being the most, you know, unself-aware entity on the planet. Trump is the alpha at that.
Oh, yeah.
And that's part of what his...
But look at how many times he's done it to African Americans now. Look at Don Lemon and LeBron James.
Yes.
I mean, he, again, intelligence. He went directly to their intelligence with them as well. It's a reoccurring pattern. He does it over and over again, and yet he's Teflon Don. I mean, nothing sticks.
So here comes a totally unfair question that I'm going to cringe while I'm asking it, and you're going to death stare me when I ask it to you. What is a racist anymore? Did we ever, I mean, how do you, what is racist? Maybe we've lost track of that a little bit. Maybe, I think there's certainly something there's an argument to be made that definition has expanded so wide that it's lost some of its traditional meaning.
And I think there's some truth to that. I mean, I think if you go back to the original definition, it was the belief in the superiority of one race over another, based on certain characteristics or genetic advantages, inherent capabilities. Now, there is a lot of somebody can say something inherently crude or uncomfortable doesn't necessarily mean they're a racist. We have tended as a society to say, oh, that's racist, or this is racist. Anything
without really
just
putting much thought into
Without much thought.
Racist
right.
sometimes is code for, I don't like that.
Right.
So therefore, I'm just going to say
that makes me uncomfortable. That was not well said. That's not appropriate.
That's right.
We kind of confuse racist, what's something that's inappropriate, with being racist, or something that's you know, completely off the cuff, or just, you know, what's the terminology I want to use? But basically something that's racially insensitive. So there's a good point. Something can be racially insensitive, but not necessarily racist.
Just because I'm insensitive, does that make me racist?
Right.
And I'll admit, for two white dudes, this is an extremely hard topic.
It is,
about.
I mean, we're not.
Because you just don't know where does this boundary line where does that exist anymore? And I cue this up because for 3 days we've heard about the N-word tape. I think most people expect a tape to come out at some point in time with Trump using that term and using it in a horrible context, using it in a context that there's no other way to interpret it as he is making a racist statement.
Right.
And what is the blowback, if any, going to be? I think we're past the point of, does it exist? Eventually it will come out. We get back to Tom Arnold and the quest that he's been on for the past 3 months. My guess is sometime mid-October, 2 weeks before the midterm, something will drop as an October surprise. I think they're holding these for the exact time to try to get the max effect out of it. But
Right. I mean, in that context, you know, you have Sarah Sanders Huckabee who can't categorically deny it, which lends it more credibility. That was painful to watch.
I occasionally listen to Fox News, and Dana Perino is like, I've had that job for G-Dub. The answer to that question is, absolutely, I can guarantee you that. She's like, that's the answer you give. That's the answer any other person in that
press secretary would give. Yeah.
It's almost makes you, and I don't, but it almost makes you feel sorry for Sarah Huckabee Sanders for having to stand there knowing within 4 to 6 weeks that press conference is going to be about, hey, this tape came out. What do you think of it?
Right. And she's going to have to answer to that.
She's going to have to answer for it.
Yeah. And so, blowback, I don't expect any, because I think we've far surpassed that point. Look, there was no blowback among his base for the Access Hollywood tape that came out back in, you know, prior election. And I mean, you know, the stuff he said on there, talk about, you know, being misogynistic and completely inappropriate towards women. But, you know, we just completely moved past that, and that became a non-issue. I mean, if that was a non-issue, why would this be any different? I mean, and again, this is just working up. It's not like there was anything leading up to this. We have all of these, you know, tweets that he's, you know, made. We've had his entire past history when it's come to African Americans.
Yeah.
When it came to the Central Park, was it
Central Park Five?
Five, yeah. And the fact, you know, the ads that he took out against them.
So let's take that. I think there are three things I can factually say about Donald Trump and race. Not making a claim that he's a racist, but here's three things that I'm just going to let there as fact. Number one, his father was arrested at a Ku Klux Klan rally. Mm-hmm. That is a fact. I'm not saying that just because your dad was at a Klan arrest, draw your own conclusions, but it is a fact that his dad was arrested as a participant at a Ku Klux Klan rally. Second one is that I think this was in the 70s.
The housing discrimination.
Well, the housing discrimination is the federal government sued Donald Trump, and I believe won, or it was settled. I'm sure it was probably settled.
I think it was settled.
But it was settled in a manner that he gave money to these folks.
Right.
They sued him for discriminatory practices against African Americans at his rental properties. That is just a fact. That the federal government looked at his practices, found enough evidence that they charged him and took him to court. I think they settled it out of court, mm-hmm. but he paid a settlement off to that. And then three, with the Central Park Five, he ran an ad, I think calling for the death penalty for five African-American teens accused of an assault in Central Park.
Who were exonerated.
And then after they were exonerated, refused to recant that.
Right.
We can debate what is the modern and appropriate definition of racism, but you stack those three facts in front of somebody, I think the logical conclusion is this is a gentleman who has certain thoughts about race that a lot of Americans would be uncomfortable with.
Right. And at the very least, the fact that he is the leader of the free world now, and, you know, he oversees agencies that are tasked with fair housing practices, anti-discrimination practices, EEOC. I mean, it's pretty alarming. And so you have to factor that in. And I mean, it gets back to that very uncomfortable question that, you know, Kellyanne Conway couldn't name. I mean, there's no senior black administration official now. She named somebody by first name who's not even in any type of White House leadership role. It's just non-existent now.
So it's easy for me as a Dem, and this is for 2 weeks in a row where I'm going to take shots at you for being, I'm going to take an easy pot shot at you for being a Republican. And we talked about this a little bit before we went on. Republicans have been poking that you had a good word for them. It's not, they've been poking at that white supremacist part of their base for a while. I said white supremacist. You said it much better.
So racial anxiety.
Racial anxiety. So they've been stoking that racial anxiety really for the past 20 to 30 years, hoping that, hey, we're going to bleed off some political support for it, but we're not going to do it enough that it blows up in our face. That's one of the dangers of Trump, is has that blown up in your face now.
Right. And so for a while, it was something the party was divided on. So you can go back to Nixon's Southern strategy. I mean, that's really kind of where that started, you know, and as, you know, basically the South, you know, migrated to the Republican Party from the Democrat Party in terms of a bastion, it really started to take shape. You have to realize the history. The Republican Party was mainly a party of Northerners. I mean, it was a lot of kind of Northeast, East Coast, kind of moderate Rockefeller Republicans. And then that changed over the last, 50 years. And the party became more Southern-based in many aspects. And now, you know, the South, for all intents and purposes, is, solidly Republican. And so though that anxiety, that the racial anxiety, that came much more to the forefront. It was an aspect within one segment of the party. And it kind of came to the forefront as the kind of a major factor that was employed in election after election. But now it's taken on a whole new tone because we have a president who...
He's playing to that on a daily basis.
Right.
But it's fair for me to say that the Republican Party has been winking and nodding at that section of the country and folks who do have anxiety about the falling number of white Americans and increased immigration, and we'll call it the browning of America and what that means for them socially and economically. I think it's fair to say the Republicans, they've kind of coddled that along.
Well, I mean, I disagree somewhat. I think it depends. I think on the presidential level, we haven't had a Republican president who's done that kind of at the forefront. We've had aspects of the party. We've had party leaders. We've had leading candidates for Congress do that in their campaigns. But it hasn't been like a DC top of the party, implementation.
It has until now.
Until now.
It feels like, and again, Republicans get a pass on Donald Trump as he is a once in a lifetime phenomenon. That once that phenomenon burns out, the goal is, and I think the expectation is, we return back to, we return back to like Mitt Romney, who we may not like his policy, or G-Dub, who I didn't think he was. He certainly had issues with the lead up to the Iraq war, but he's not the type of personal wrecking ball that Donald Trump is.
Exactly. I mean, more of a traditional Republican, kind of in line with, Mitt Romney, too, again, is, of that kind of moderate, more kind of New England, type of Republicanism. So, again, it harkens back to a very different time in the party.
So, I mean, that's a conversation that we have to have, because that's going to get pushed to the forefront, I think, very quickly from now to the midterms. The racial angle to this is only going to get worse as talk of these tapes keep growing and growing. If you believe Omarosa, she's got a whole library of these. If you follow Tom Arnold on Twitter, he's chasing down producers and people, who are on the set at the time. I think it's only a matter of time until one of these tapes come out, and it forces us into this uncomfortable conversation where I don't know what we do. I don't, half the people, or there's a section of people, Trump's base is just going to ignore it and say it's not that big a deal. It was baked in the cake. It's not why I voted for him anyway. My side is going to completely, present this as the worst thing ever in the history of America, and this is our downfall. And I don't know where usually you say the truth lies somewhere in the middle, but with this one, I got no, what is that middle anymore? Because this is like the fifth thing that Trump's done that would have sunk anybody.
Well, and what type of reaction do we expect from Trump if and when it'll be, I mean, he's not going to apologize.
It's fake. Tape's fake. I mean, he'll spend 3 months doing that.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, he's still arguing the authenticity of the Access Hollywood tape.
Absolutely. He claims he's not going to come out and be, he's not going to come out and say, hey, that was a mistake. Like he did with the Access Hollywood tapes where he made that hostage video and, you know, Saturday Night Live had a great thing where like, I was a very immature 59-year-old man when I said that about women. What's he going to say? Yeah. I mean, I'm 72 years old. I've suddenly changed my opinion on what I had when I was 65.
Right.
That's ridiculous. I think he just comes out and owns it and says, hey, I said it when the best thing to say, I don't get really politically correct and let's move on.
Yeah. I mean, he's going to turn it back on the individual he said it about and, you know, and find some way, I think, to attack that person again and frame it in terms of, you know, it's his fault. It's all about him. It's because of X, Y, and Z. I mean, he's really good at turning, you know, things back on people because he doesn't take responsibility for what he says and does. It's always thrown back at somebody else.
I can remember sitting there and I think I saw it live. And I forget what interview it was with when he said about John McCain, I prefer my war heroes. All he did was get captured. And I remember thinking, we're done. That's it. It's over. Nobody is going to survive that. The Republican Party will turn on him and we are done. And he just straight through it.
Yeah.
And I think it was after that, it was Mexicans are rapist and illegal. I thought, we're done. We're done. Never going to survive this.
And he's stubborn. He does not change. Nope. And this is a little bit of a side topic, but you mentioned John McCain. He signed defense bill that was named in honor of John McCain. And at the event over the weekend where he named every military general and gave praise, he left out John McCain's name. I mean, again, just
on purpose to be a dick.
Exactly.
It's who he is.
Because, again, I mean, he can't set aside his personal grudges and, you know, what he harbors to even in a professional setting to, you know, give praise and to somebody. I mean, he can't.
So what do you think? And I agree that was disgusting and gross. And it's like, you've got to be kidding me. As the president of the United States and leader of the free world, you can't put your petty grievance away for 20 minutes to say the name of a guy who will go down in history as an American hero.
Right.
I thought that was just, that's just Trump in a nutshell. What do you think about recording people?
You know, I think
as you speak into a microphone and putting this down on tape,
this is recorded for posterity.
Would you ever record somebody at work?
I think only under the condition if I thought something was illegal was happening and I was acting like in a whistleblower capacity.
Yeah.
I think because I have seen that done before.
Yeah.
I think that there's almost a responsibility to do so, but I think you have to tread cautiously. I don't think under any other scenario, I think you have to be very careful about doing something.
So let's
like
say
that.
We work together and we're just work enemies. We just don't like each other and we had different departments and all that crap that happens in a normal work relationship. And I bait you into saying something and tape you. Is that immoral? And then I use it to my advantage. I'm like, hey, we're up for the same promotion. I'm like, really? Listen to what Brandon said. Is that immoral on my part?
I think it's unethical. Implies trust issues, and it would be hard for you to be trusted again, not just by me, but anybody else you work with, because everybody else could be like,
yeah, you better not say anything.
Right, we're not going to be around that guy. Yeah. We're going to, you know. So I think that's where you have to be really careful, because it's lack of trust, and you lose it. I don't know how you gain it back after that. Again, for something like that, I mean, I think if there's something, you know, massive illegal fraud going on or some type of scheme, you know, and maybe you're working with the FBI, you know, as a whistleblower, there's
that's one thing.
Difference, but I think just to gain a promotion or gain the upper hand and you know advancement and
I guess from my age group we always go taping back to Nixon and that has that real swarmy kind of connotation to it. I'm assuming that still holds.
That's I think folks. That's still the case. I've never personally seen an example where I've witnessed somebody taping somebody else, or yeah. even condoning it. It's one of those things that I think. But again, this White House, from what we've heard, everybody records everybody.
If you were in this White House and you knew something was going to happen, let's say too, one of the big other reveals from Omarosa this week is she was on with Katie Turi on MSNBC and said, yes, that Mueller had contacted her and that absolutely Trump knew everything about the WikiLeaks dump of the DNC emails prior to it happens. So she kind of confirmed the narrative that Trump or somebody within Trump's orbit specifically worked with the Russians to coordinate that. Now, again, how do you split a hair here between who's being dishonest between Omarosa and Trump?
Yeah, I can't, that's a problem. Omarosa is not trustworthy, and we know that now, too. But she was in the inner circle. So,
and she's got some recordings.
Right. And so she has already released some of those.
If two people are known to be completely dishonest and untrustworthy, I guess you default to the person who has the tape.
Right.
Did you hear how she recorded people?
Was it with a pen?
It was with the pen.
I had heard that was the suspicion. I didn't know it was confirmed. Yeah. So it was with one of the spy pens.
I went on Amazon. For $119, you could buy a really good one.
Okay.
That's like 20 gig worth of storage. You could record hours. And it just looks like a pin, and you just click it, and it records. So she had it in her purse, in her pocket, set it on table, whatever. But I will admit that I'm like, what? I hadn't thought of a recording pin. So like everything that you need, you just go to Amazon and there it is.
Technology.
You could buy one. Anybody could be recording any type of conversation.
Yeah.
And you just never know. So is she, the other thing they made a big deal about, that it was in the Situation Room. That's ridiculous, because what makes the Situation Room are the conversations that happen in it, not the room itself.
Right. But I mean, it still was a major violation of protocol.
So she will never have
a security clearance again.
But it wasn't anything illegal.
It wasn't illegal. No. And in fact, I mean, the Trump administration saying that they're going to go after her, they can't. There's nothing illegal.
They can't. And people have already said that's just Trump blowing off some steam.
But it is a serious protocol violation. And again, it speaks to the fact, the type of person he hired. He hires these types of people. So why would you not expect this?
She also turned down, I believe, she turned down $15,000 a month.
Campaign.
When she left. Just to keep her mouth shut.
Oh, okay.
Because there's the other guy who was Trump's bodyguard for years.
Right.
Who was in the White House. I forget his name. Like the big bald guy.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
And when he left, he got, it's a standard deal.
They offer them these jobs on the campaign. Correct. That really have no responsibilities.
So
it's a payoff.
She's making $180,000 a year doing nothing. She had no responsibilities.
Yeah.
She traveled around and talked occasionally. You and I, if we got into that gravy boat, we would just say, we're staying in here as long as we can.
Yeah.
I think she immediately looks at this as an opportunity to how do I take the next level of attention. Monetary. I think she got $1 million advance for her book.
Right.
I mean, she just saw as she walked on the set of The Apprentice or Big Brother or whatever, how am I going to spin this reality show that I'm in to my advantage?
And she's used to playing the villain, and she has relished that role. And so now she's kind of in a little bit different role as kind of whistleblower, I'm here to save America, and it's, but again, it all goes back to her number one priority is herself. And how she brands herself and what she can do to keep her, brand going and alive.
This is the go-to move now. If you've done something scummy, just roll over on everybody and say, there's so many of you that want saved from what's happening in the country right now. I switch from the villain to the hero by I'm going to be the one who saves you and brings down this president.
Right.
And I'm shocked at the number of people on my side, and I say shocked sarcastically, who openly embrace that.
Yeah.
Again, it proves out, and this is true on all sides of the political spectrum. You can be a bad person as long as you're doing good things for me. I'll just excuse anything you do.
Well, let's not forget Omarosa. Right up until the point that she was fired, she was still Trump's attack dog. I mean, she was on the offensive on all of the TV shows defending him, and then she does a 180, it's worked out well for her.
I still struggle with this. Has been 6 days of this.
We'd even get 5 or 6 days on Russia or North Korea during the summit.
Helsinki thing didn't last this long. And it's, again, it's what you said. She knows how to work it.
Yeah.
She has contacts. She is a good interview.
She is. And I think that she's appealing, I think, from the media's perspective, because she, you know, she has this image, this reputation. She, you know, has cultivated that.
Yeah.
And that's why, I mean, you know, that's the reason Donald Trump brought her back on many series of seasons of The Apprentice, was because of the ratings.
Like three times or something. Yes. In some tweet like, oh, she's terrible. She was fired three times on The Apprentice. The Apprentice wasn't real.
No, it was orchestrated.
A fake show.
I mean, the boardroom. Who cares? That boardroom was not even a real boardroom they used. It was all orchestrated for the TV show. None of it was real.
The last thing I think I've got on Omarosa is, I think why she is a legitimate threat to Trump is that she employs the same tactics Trump employs. And the number one tactic and the number one trait that Omarosa has that makes her dangerous, zero shame in what she does. She will lie to your face and not care. She will record you. I don't think, much like Trump, there is no limit to what she will do.
No.
And not give it a single second thought. I think Trump, for maybe for the first time since he's been president and has started a feud with somebody, he might be dealing with a big a psycho as he is.
Yeah, she doesn't back down. She continues to fight back. Yeah.
Simply doesn't care. And we've already seen in the Tuesday primaries that the female Republican voter is gone. That's already evaporated. As Trump and Omarosa get into this, what part of the electorate does this impact, if any? I don't think it really impacts African American voters, because there was only what, under 10%
voted to begin
for
with.
Him, and there's no. Does this energize people downstream to go to the polls and just pull a straight Democratic ticket?
I mean, I think it provides confirmation. I mean, it's just, again, it's another affirmation of what people already think and know, and here's somebody else saying it. I don't think it's as strong just because of the baggage that Omarosa has that she brings with her. So I think people are like, yeah, we think she's right. We don't necessarily buy all the details, though, because we know that she embellishes and exaggerates, and, you know, and at the end of the day, her motives are different than the good of the country. But, you know, there is, you know, credibility there, because we've heard this before, and here's somebody from inside the White House saying, yeah, this is what I saw and heard, and I have, you know, recordings, and here, you know, and there's
it's
more.
Just her lack, I use the word shame, because I don't know what else to say, but it's that thing that we've all done things where we have screwed people over. Sometimes we've done it unintentionally. Sometimes we do it intentionally. Or we've acted poorly.
Right.
At work, in personal lives, whatever. Most normal human beings take that to heart, and it doesn't make them feel good. And they try to avoid doing that type of behavior again. Trump and Omarosa, they're just that special breed of human that just doesn't impact them at all.
And no guilt, no regrets.
No guilt, regret. I'm going to call you terrible names. You're going to come. And we just, in some ways, we thrive on it. We eat it up. It fuels us to go even more down that path. This is two forces.
They're cut from the same cloth, and that's what's so fascinating about this.
To attention. God, I was going to say a word.
I know what you're going to say.
I was going to call them both attention whores.
Right.
Because there's no other way to say
it. Yeah, that's what
they are. Two attention whores that will do anything to say, look at me, look at me, look at me.
Right.
They both go with the philosophy, I'd rather be a dumpster fire than be ignored. If you're in this for the entertainment value, it's no better than this. And it's only going to get worse.
Right. To go back to your point, I don't think it necessarily, like, for example, impacts a major demographic like women, unless Trump continues to devolve into, like, very misogynistic attacks on her. I think then it starts to resonate.
Yeah, but I think we've seen that support's gone.
That's gone. So, again, back. I think it's just, it definitely, it plays into the what we already know, gives credence to that. And I think it's, again, it's just the onslaught of negative damning information when it comes to this White House. No. I mean, it just, it's reinforcement. And there's been no break. I mean, yeah. It's just one thing after another. And it's like, if you're Sarah Huckabee Sanders, how do you at some point just not throw in the towel and be like, okay, I'm done?
Well, because you can't, if you've made it this far, you've just hollowed out you're just an empty shell. Yeah. You've just decided, for some reason, being in the White House and this proximity to power is worth every shred of my humanity, and so be it. That's what I'm going to do. I don't think you and I have ever chased power in a way that it was worth becoming just an empty suit or right. an empty human vessel. And I think that's what Sarah Huckabee Sanders is.
Well, and as we've discussed before, I think many of these former administration officials have very dim prospects,
they're
job prospects
so
after
toxic
the administration.
When they get done.
So yeah. I guess your only choice would be ride this out as long as you can.
She's waited too long. I think that's a great observation that she's been there for so long. She's done what she's done. You can't, I mean, ask Sean Spicer about how his book tour is going and the stops he's making. You've seen Megyn Kelly just rip into him for 15 minutes. You saw the folks in London. My God, they just were all over him. Samantha Bee had one of her staff members follow him around and ask him questions at every single book signing about, do you feel any regret for I mean, that's what's coming for all of these folks when they leave that administration.
Right. It actually makes me think, I mean, Anthony Scaramucci, who was there for all of like 10 days.
I like him more than anybody.
Yeah, and he's actually been fairly honest and very fairly critical.
He has been.
And
do
I
you
think
follow him on Twitter?
I do, yeah.
He's a good Twitter follower.
He is. And I think that I think lucked out because he wasn't there long enough for him to be completely, you know, I think, branded with, you know, the Trump name to where it's going to hurt his career prospects. I mean, it was fleeting.
Yeah.
And I think he's really built himself up now as like an independent critic.
He's done more with his 10 days at the White House than anybody can remember.
Yeah, you're leveraging that.
Don't you think Scaramucci got mad at something? He got caught up in this, I want to portray myself as a tough guy.
Yeah.
If you're a dude, all guys have been there. And he chose a language path that he probably, if he had to do it again, 9 out of 10 times, probably wouldn't have done it. Because some of his remarks are well thought out. They're measured. He does criticize. And that's just something.
And that was a side of him we didn't see in those 10 days. Now, right.
Absolutely. Yeah. Scaramucci is somebody who I think has resurrected his image and is somebody that's going to find a much longer career after he was done at the White House. I'm just waiting for Omarosa to appear at the next Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez
rally.
I butched that again. And rally, you know, and we hold her up as some sort of heroine now for the bravery that she's showing. Because while we all may find her personally disgusting, if she's the one who puts the tree toppling of the Trump administration, we'll forget all of it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, another narrative.
God, that's going to happen too. That is so gross, but it's going to happen.
And in Omarosa's story, she went from, you know, being Democrat, Clinton White House, which she did last long there because, I mean, she was not good at her job.
No.
And then, you know, Republican and then maybe Democrat savior. I mean, yeah, it's fascinating.
Did you see that picture Roger Stone tweeted out of Space Force?
No.
Not tweeted. He put it on Instagram.
Oh, okay. I didn't see that. No.
So somebody made a photo of Space Force and it was
there's
Roger
so many good
Stone
memes going around.
It,
here,
it was a meme of Roger Stone, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Mike Pence, President Trump, and one other person. That wasn't the catchy part. The real the real thing that you wanted to catch
the caption
on, on their spacesuits, they all were wearing a swastika patch.
Oh.
And Roger Stone,
he retweeted it.
He took it off Instagram and he reposted it on Instagram.
Oh.
With a thing of like, I love this picture. It's like, what? What in the world are you doing?
I can't even.
That was our subtle pivot to Paul Manafort, the criminal, the silly criminal portion of the podcast each week, where we have to remind everybody it's really hard to commit crimes. Most criminals aren't very smart.
Exactly.
And shock of shocks, most of the time when you're caught, you go to jail.
Exactly. Trial wrapped up today. So jury going to begin deliberating. And the defense presented no case.
We rest. We're good.
No witnesses, good. No cross-examination, nothing. Yeah, so that was interesting.
I've watched a lot of criminal shows. I get it that the defense, there's a couple of theories about the defense. One is they really had no defense.
Yeah.
And everybody that they were not going to put Paul Manafort on the stand.
Oh, no.
He is the only one who could offer any type of explanation for the behavior that was presented at the thing. And they knew that the government lawyers would tear him apart. Plus, two, they wanted the judge, they wanted all of that back and forth and confrontation he had with the prosecutor being fresh in people's minds.
Yeah.
So they're like, let's just go ahead and go and say we rest. If you weren't going to put it on a defense, why did you even go to trial?
Yeah.
Why didn't you cut a deal and just get on with it?
That's what I don't understand. Yeah, I mean, go through no all this sense. Expense. I mean, they seem to think that, you know, their case rests on the credibility of Rick Gates and, you know, basically saying he's not credible because he's lied, cheated, been
sure.
committed fraud, he's had affairs.
Everything Paul Manafort's done.
Everything Paul Manafort did. But, I mean, that's really the crux of their case. I mean, so it's just they don't have much there.
You have to suspend your belief that Paul Manafort had no idea that Rick Gates was doing this.
Right.
That this is a man who has been in this world for 40 plus years and was just the absolute, you know, babe in the woods, knew nothing that was going on, which would make him the stupidest human being on the planet.
And completely not credible because, I mean, his relationship with Rick Gates goes back decades. I mean, Rick Gates started working for him as a low-level staffer, I mean, pretty young age. And so, I mean, and then he tapped Rick again to come back and work for him later. I mean, so
there's no
credibility there.
There's no way. So let's say that should wrap up in the next day or so. I can't imagine, unless something goes sideways, and it's a jury trial and you never know.
Right.
If they come back and go guilty on this, I believe Manafort has another trial he's got to. I don't think this is his only trial. I think he's got another one.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
That they have to go. But I would think, again, at that point, and I don't, again, all of my law experience has been off watching TV. Can he still cut a deal? Are they still interested in him? He's 69 years old.
Yeah.
And if you're already looking at a 12-year mandatory sentence or an 18-year or whatever he gets, my point is you're already spending the rest of your life in jail.
Right.
What possible incentive or what possibly could you bring to me that makes me now want to deal with you?
Exactly. I think that's a big question. And I'm kind of shocked that he did not choose to go that route already.
I don't think they offered him one. I'm going under the impression that Mueller maybe has what he wants to have, and he made a calculation that it's a bigger shot across the bow to put him in jail for the rest of his life.
That's a good point, yeah.
Or force Trump to pardon him.
Right.
And I think that's the other part of this, that maybe there's going, if Trump pardons him, all hell breaks loose at that point. At some point, the Republicans in the Senate reach their breaking point. I don't know what that would be yet, but a Manafort pardon is going to stretch, I think, is about as far as they can go.
Yeah, I think we've said from the beginning, Manafort pardon or Rod Rosenstein fired.
That'd be another one.
Those would be, I mean, two of those breaking points that something would have to give.
But a Rosenstein firing, Trump could shield himself from that a little bit. I mean, he could bake that into, you know, Nunez and Meadows. And there's a way I could see him maneuvering around that, hey, all this FBI corruption and all of that. There's a story he could spin about that. But him pardoning, that's all him. You can't wiggle out of that one.
There's nobody involved.
If you commit a crime and as your President Fred, I pardon you.
Right.
I can't deflect that anywhere else. And I don't know, but I mean, is Manafort acting? Manafort doesn't seem that concerned that for a dude that's 70 years old, he's about to spend the twilight of his life in prison.
Yeah, I mean, he's pretty, you know, calm and low-key about all this. I mean, his demeanor seems to indicate that.
Maybe that's just the kind of psycho he is, that he still thinks he's going to get out of this, that he's going to get away with it. There's no way any of this would ever come back to him.
Egos, dealing with big egos.
God. So if that goes the way, let's run down both scenarios. He's guilty. He's guilty on multiple accounts. He's going to spend a serious amount of the rest of his life in jail. To me, that just leads credence to the Mueller investigation. And it leads credence to, again, I don't think anybody buys into this fake witch hunt stuff narrative that Trump still pushes. But this would be the first time in less than 2 years we've had multiple indictments, multiple guilty pleas, and there are people in jail. I mean, if that doesn't really kind of, you know, send a chill up Trump's spine that, hey, this is getting closer and closer, I don't know what is.
Yeah, there's too many connections at this point. And again, I think you're right about the message that Mueller is trying to send. And, you know, Trump has tweeted more than a couple times, you know, that he feels sorry for Manafort for what he's going through. And you know, and that he's a good man, great guy. I forget the exact language.
Yeah.
But, I mean, hey, if you were going to send a message to the president and you know, he's not accepting responsibility for anything Manafort has done.
No.
This is the way you send a message. Can't get stronger than that.
And people too, this was his campaign chair.
Yeah.
During one of the most critical, at the convention in Cleveland, this was the guy running the show.
And he brought him on knowing his history, knowing his past, knowing his history. All of the controversy.
Right at a point in time where he couldn't pay any of his bills, he volunteered for a position.
Right.
Come on. It just doesn't get much slimier.
It doesn't pass a smell test at all.
So this is another one of those weeks that you wake up every day, you immediately go to your phone and you kind of half want to see what's happening and half are like, you know what, if my phone kind of blew up or I could live with that this week. Because everything coming out is just silly and dumb and kind of vaudevillian show. It just, at some point, it's just like, I've had about enough of the Omarosa thing as I could consume. What do you think of Alexandria what's her real name again?
Ocasio.
Why can't I say Ocasio?
You always forget that, yeah.
What do you think of AOC and the little feud she had with Ben Shapiro? Were you aware of that one?
I heard a little bit about it. I know he challenged her to a debate and offered to contribute to her campaign.
To a campaign or a charity.
I didn't hear her response back, though. I get to see that.
She basically said, I don't respond to catcalls on the street. I don't respond to men with bad intentions. It was like a catcall is how she kind of equated that to. If anybody listens to or knows anything about Ben Shapiro, that's not his MO.
No, not at all. I mean, he is pretty policy focused. Even if you don't agree with him, he's not.
Yeah.
And he's probably the furthest thing you can get from Trump in terms of.
He is a devout Orthodox Jew. I don't think that was his intent.
No.
Is there something distasteful that he offered her money? Is that the point that got off pace, that as a man I'm offering you money to do something that I want you to do? I'm reaching here for the far lefts. I mean, these are folks on my team, but they're way over there.
And again, I think went way
I'm trying to feel your outrage.
Identity politics.
I just can't get there.
I don't get it either, because I see, I mean, those types of offers and scenarios happen all the time. I see them in so many settings. Like, hey, if you do this, I mean, it's not, and I've even in the political setting, I've heard, you know, particularly candidates that want to have more debates will offer that. And although the context is a little bit different, they offer to donate to a charity of the candidate's choice. But again, that's nothing out of the ordinary. I mean, I didn't see any shock value in it. And so I think that, that reaction, I think, was over the top. I think that, you know, could have probably been handled differently. She could have laughed it off. And in many ways, or come up with a retort.
And I bring that up because when you're faked outraged all the time, when something actually happens, and I think we touched on this a little bit last week with Laura Ingraham,
yeah,
comes out and makes that type of statement. Sometimes you, if you're angry all the time and outraged constantly, you don't pay attention.
You lose focus of the big picture. Yeah.
Or you don't have any energy left for something that happens that we should really feel much more outrage about.
Right. There's only so much time and attention you can devote, you know, in the course of a day. So I think that was a mistake. I mean, it's
Laura Ingraham's been saying shit like that for
No, it's talking about Ocasio-Cortez. Okay. Yeah. No, Laura Ingraham, I think that was deliberate. Yeah.
Multiple times.
Yeah. And I mean, her attempt to walk that back and, you know, claim context. I mean, it was pretty clear. I mean, I don't know how much clearer you could say
it. We're getting browner and white people don't like it.
Yeah. I mean, what other context could that be in if it wasn't racial? There is no other context. I mean, is it age? Is we don't want young people?
Yes.
No, that's the only other demographic attribute you can go to, and that's it's entirely racial. It's the country is not
absolutely
does it look like what it did.
It's not what it used to be, and there's one thing that's making it. It's illegal immigration and people that aren't supposed to be here, and in the air quotes is not white.
Right.
I don't know how else you can interpret what that is. I wanted to give everybody an update on Mike. So I had a couple people on the pod ping me this week and say, I can't believe you guys didn't talk about Mike. Mike did not win the third district primary. Charisse Graves?
Davids. Charisse Davids.
Again, my struggle with names in the English language continues. She won. She beat Brett Wilder.
Welder.
Thank you, Brandon.
She had 37%. Brett Wilder
had 36.4%.
Okay. Yep.
It was a fairly close.
It was close. Race. Very close.
So Mike is unpacking some of the things with his campaign. He and I had lunch today. And sometime in the next week or so, next couple podcasts, he'll come on. He's got a lot of interesting observations and stories about what his experience was in that campaign that I think people really find
insights from the front lines. So eager to hear that.
And again, if I don't live in the third, do you live in the third?
I do. Yeah. So okay. We're in the third right now.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
Mike made an interesting observation at lunch today that, you know, there were two people in that race that took PAC money. And if you totaled up everybody else's votes, they wouldn't have come in. You wouldn't have beaten the second guy, Wilder. Wilder. So it was an interesting observation of what is the actual impact of big money when you dump 800,000 to a million into a primary race like that. What's the result you get? Mike's also doing a lot of really interesting, and anybody knows or works with Mike knows he's a data-driven
very
marketing
analytical
guy.
Yeah.
So he's doing some postmortems on with some surveying and finding, you know, what really impacted a lot of folks, when did they make their decision, and a lot of good evidence about what traditional media and what traditional money still does in politics.
I'm eager to hear, you know, the results from that and kind of his personal view, because we hear, you know, over and over again, this repetition that, you know, people are, you know, disgusted by, you know, the use of PAC money and just the you know, big contributions, and you see it in social media, people, you know, upset with it. But at the end of the day, they don't vote differently. Like it impacts their vote.
Because
like,
if she wins, she won on PAC money.
Right.
I think, again, it was interesting that Welder, the RNC started paying for commercials. And in some weird way, kind of supporting him. Did you see
any of
those?
Well, there's a conservative pack called InSpending that actually ran ads for him.
Okay.
Like touting, you know, all of his socialist credentials, and then, you know, ending with he's too liberal for Kansas. So it's a setup where you thought it was a pro-Welder ad, and then by the end of it, you realize, oh no, that's not for him.
I think Mike said that that group spent five times Mike's total spend in campaigns somewhat supporting that candidate than he spent total.
I would believe it. That ad played many times on television.
Multiple times. And what's interesting too is this gets to identity politics. You know, certainly, I think both of us think it's outstanding that the number of women that are running, the number of women that are winning, but it just kind of gets to where we are right now. We took a dive through women's political psychology last week that we won't attempt to repeat that again.
Right.
But it talks about how people are identifying with righting a wrong. They're identifying with a candidate that is going to fight something that they perceive needs to be fight, and how all of that kind of coalesced in the third. So it should be pretty interesting stuff.
Exactly. When you feel like, you know, opportunity and everything is going backwards, you know, you try to right that ship, you usually go, you know, pretty clear, you know, in one direction. And I think that's what we're seeing play out.
Well, and it'll be interesting for Mike, because Mike put more feet on the ground, I think, than any other candidate easily in that race. And I think what he's learning is a lot of people didn't really start paying attention till, you know, 10-7 days out. And when that's when you start picking this up, you kind of immediately switch to who's the person most like me? Whose politics of identity do I gravitate to? And that's really what.
And I'd be interested to hear what percentage of the electorate he thinks are late deciders versus, you know, those that are engaged early. Because Mike was very engaged with the grassroots.
Absolutely.
You know, months ago.
Did that help any?
Yeah, that's the question. That's what I'd love to hear from him.
Yeah. Yeah. And I told Mike this today, but I think Mike was working under the assumption that there's a group of people that could move from one candidate to a centrist candidate.
Yeah.
I just don't think that's the case.
Yeah, and that's just not the message that's resonating this year.
My wife tells a great story that she's at lunch with some women she works with, and they mention Mike's signage and his over Yoder, and they're like, yeah, we really like that. That's really sharp. And it's like, are you going to vote for Mike? Absolutely not. It's the female. It's the woman in the race, because it's important that we have to have it. And that's not taking anything away from her qualifications or ability to do the job. It's just elections go in cycles, and sometimes you ride the cycle, sometimes the cycle rides over you.
Right. And that's what we're seeing play out.
Yeah. Yep. Think she'll beat Yoder?
I don't see that. I think it'll be a closer race, definitely closer race than we've seen in the past. I think it really depends on what happens nationally in the next couple months, but it's still a tough hill to climb. I mean, everything would have to go right for her.
And did you see where Yoder already came out with some talk track in the campaign that, you know, she really doesn't fit Kansas values?
Right. Yep,
that's that came out immediately. I mean, just say it.
So, and you know, you have to consider with her too, she has no political background. She's a political neophyte.
As far as we've seen from what she did in the third, she has no political platform.
I mean, she did serve in the Obama White House, but in terms of elected office, I mean, she has no background. And so that's a positive and a negative. It's a positive in that it allows her to run against this entrenched establishment that is not, you know, doing their jobs in Congress. Yeah. But it's also a negative in that, you know, she will need people to advise her on how to anticipate, you know, what the attacks and what's lobbied at her, and how to be proactive in running a campaign.
Effort, you know. Female candidates in primaries have been overperforming by about 15%.
Right.
It'll be interesting to see what percentage of that carries into a general against an established Republican like Yoder in what should be, I mean, this ain't deep, deep red, but it's pretty red.
It is pretty red. What gives Democrats the feeling that they have a chance here is that it was a +1 Hillary district in 2016.
Yeah.
So it is a swing district. It was held by Dennis Moore for four terms, you know, moderate Democrat congressman. And it's typically been held by more moderate Republicans, but we'll see. I mean, it's, you know, so much depends on the national mood and it depends on the energy level. We did see, I think, last I calculated the numbers, about 8% Democrats voted at a rate of 8% more than the last primary. And with Republicans, I think it was steady. There was no increase.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's momentum on their side.
There's evidence that that the big blue is coming, that it's not going to be one of the wipeouts, just simply like a 50-60, just because the districts aren't drawn that way. But winning the House back with a 12 to 15 seat margin is probably very doable at this point. All right.
I agree.
I think we're at our hour for the week. You got anything else we need to talk about? Any more Omarosas? Any more taping? Anything?
No, we pretty much covered that, I think.
I did look for there's an app. There's like all kinds of apps you can get on your phone to record conversations. I might buy one of those just to tape a conversation to see what it works like. Just to see what it is.
Research purposes,
my wife
right?
would love that if I taped a conversation I had with her.
Oh, my gosh. I wouldn't want to be there to see her reaction.
No. I'll see you next week, Brandon.
See you later, Craig.